This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Esther Sternberg. She's an immunologist and the author of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. I spoke with her on March 30th, 2012, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was in the studios of public radio station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Download the MP3 of the produced show with Esther Sternberg at onbeing.org.
Do you want me to talk?
Can you hear me now? Good.
I can hear you.
Yeah, I wasn't hearing myself there for a minute. All right, I'm not hearing the echo now. How are you, Esther?
I think I was. Let me see if I hear it. No, I don't hear it now.
Tell me what you had for breakfast. We'll check it out.
Well, I usually have oatmeal and strawberries and blueberries.
But today
I didn't. I had to run into work early, so I had a piece of raisin and pecan toast with cream cheese.
Okay, well, that sounds good. When was it that we spoke before? When did you publish your first book?
Okay. Are we starting?
Sorry. No, I think...
Yeah, we just, Leah just called me and we reduced the level.
Am I too close to the mic?
No.
Now I hear my echo again.
That's an open studio door.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay, just count to 20 and when we get to a place that they're happy with, they'll stop us.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So Esther, when was it that you published your first book? What
year? 2000. The hardcover came out in 2000 and the paperback in 2001.
So it was later than that we met at Chautauqua, wasn't it? It was more like 2004.
2005. No, it was just we didn't realize that Katrina was happening because we were cut off from all the news there.
It was
August of mm-hmm. Katrina, and we came home and Katrina was in full force.
Okay. All right. So it's been, I can't believe this, it's been 7 years.
Well, right? I've done other shows with you with the economic crisis.
I know, but that was our big interview. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. It's about time.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me on.
Say, tell me.
First of all, are we just talking?
We're going. Okay. I want to ask you before we start. I remember previously you were not able to use your NIH credential for things
like this.
And that
is correct.
Is that still
true? That is still correct.
Okay.
That is still true.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. But I just want to make sure, just looking at Nancy, my producer back here, when it comes time, we'll need to double check with you about how we
can describe you. Yeah, and I'll give you the wording of what you can use. When do you think it'll air?
I think we're going to turn it around pretty quickly. So within the next month or two. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So I want to just start with these words from the subtitle of the book, these words, place and well-being. And I want to just ask you what those words evoke. You know, where does your mind go back earliest in your life when you put those two words together, place and well-being? I'm curious about that.
Well, it goes back to actually the first part of the last chapter of my book. I describe sitting with my father on the terrace of my house, the family home in Montreal, and listening. I could read the piece if you want.
No, just tell me. Just tell me.
I remember I was very small, probably in grade one or grade two. And my sister and mother were still getting dressed, and I was sitting at breakfast with my father outside on the terrace. We called it terrace, but you know, here in America they call it a deck. And he used to read while he ate breakfast, and there was a probably mystery story propped up against his coffee mug. he was a scientist, and, you know, but he liked to read mystery stories. And he looked up from his mug, and it was spring. It was early spring, and he looked up at me, and he said, "Listen to the sounds of peace." And I had no idea what he meant. And all I could hear was a dog barking and the puck puck of a tennis ball across on the at the courts across the street and the birds chirping. And I only understood many, many years later that for him, he was only about 10 years away from the war, from World War II, where he had discovered after his death that he'd been in a concentration camp in a place called Transnistria in Russia. And for him, he so savored those moments of peace. And my mother also. My mother had gotten to Montreal before the war. But, you know, my grandmother's family and she and her siblings had escaped literally on the last moments when the trains were leaving Romania, Germany, and, you know, eventually they got to Canada. And so they really instilled in me this sense of peace and place. Mm-hmm. We would often, we were washing the dishes, you know, after dinner, and we really couldn't see the sunset from our house, but you could tell that it was going to be a beautiful sunset. So we'd all drop everything, and my father would drive us to the top of the hill where the University of Montreal sits, and we'd sit and look at the sunset. And my parents explicitly instilled in me the knowledge that we should look, hear, smell, touch everything in our surrounding environment and savor it because this could be your last day. Mm. They actually said that to me a number of times, especially the sunset. Look at it as if it's your last.
And as you said, your father was a scientist. He was a doctor. Mm-hmm. Do you think, consciously or unconsciously, he made any kind of connection like the one you're making now as a scientist between that experience and, well, if not health, well-being?
That's a really interesting question. He certainly didn't explicitly tell me that. So in a way, in the family, I was kind of the son. There were just two, okay, me and my sister. Yeah. And from very early on, I displayed an interest in science, and I worked in my father's lab when I was a high school student and college student. And so I was very deeply steeped in the science that he did. It never had anything to do with place, physical place. He was one of the founders of the field that we now call nuclear medicine. He was involved very early on in radiation biology and the peaceful uses of radiation, and got very much involved in a big political debate in Canada where he went up against the then Minister of Defense and said that all this stuff about fallout shelters is, you know, believe me, if there's a nuclear war, you're not going to be cooking turkey in a little white pinafore in a fallout shelter. He really said that. Yeah.
But so he was using radiation to cure cancer for peaceful purposes.
Yes, for thyroid scanning, to identify thyroid cancers, to treat cancer. So he was really one of the pioneers of what we now call nuclear medicine and radiation biology. Mm. And so he was involved in a different aspect of science than thinking about place explicitly. Right. Now, he was in the same Department of Medicine as Hans Selye, who described or coined the word stress. And the two of them were, I think, often a bit at loggerheads because they were both very prominent, famous people in their departments, but coming at issues from a very different point of view. And my father was much more basic science oriented. He had a degree in physics and chemistry.
Right.
And I think I know that he thought this whole notion of stress was a little bit far out there. And and that was the 50s and 60s. And the vast majority, probably 99% of credible, rigorous scientists felt the same way.
Well, and as I've spoken with you across the years and read you, I mean, that's also pretty much the perspective you came at all of this from.
Absolutely. I, you know, it was very interesting. I when I was coming up through the ranks at McGill University and McGill University Faculty of Medicine, and when I trained as a rheumatologist at the Royal Victoria Hospital, and people would mention Hans Selye, I pretended that I didn't know him as a child. I was actually embarrassed to admit that I knew this person.
This person who was really, who now we look back and say he's the one who put the word stress in the world vocabulary.
That's absolutely right.
Huh.
That's absolutely right. But the science, and the interesting thing, and as I write in both of my books, in Healing Spaces and in the first one, in The Balance Within, I do explore a little bit of this scientific personality and how it affects the acceptance or rejection of scientific ideas. And very often, new, novel scientific ideas are rejected by, you know, by the current dogma, by the academic community. And for a person to push forward a concept like stress, and that stress could make you sick, back in the 1930s, when Hans Selye first proposed it, and through the 60s and 70s, to do that, you had to have a certain kind of almost grandiose personality to say, I'm right and everybody else is wrong.
Right. So you and I spoke for the first time in 2005, and
yes.
You had just written your first book, and you had come to a conclusion after working with your own scientific resistance. You know, one way you talked about it is that the notion that stress can make you sick, but also that believing, that loving could make you well. And this was a hard-won observation. It came for you not merely as a scientist and physician, but you had your own experience of arthritis, the
yes.
field you study. It was a question your mother was posing to you, asking you to ponder near the end of her life. Now you've kind of taken this farther. You make this observation in your more recent work that physicians and nurses know that a patient's sudden interest in external things is the first sign that healing has begun. And you ask, but do our surroundings in turn have an effect on us? So I would love, just as we're starting here, to hear a little bit about your road from believing, from understanding that stress can make us sick and that positive experiences can make us well, and connecting that so passionately to place and surroundings. Tell me how you got there. How did that happen?
Well, it was a very gradual journey, a literal journey. It was a physical journey in the real world and a journey in my own mind and a journey through scientific evidence. So for the vast majority of us coming from a scientist coming from the biological sciences, as opposed to, for instance, psychologists or psychiatrists, people who deal with emotions every day, for those of us who tend to deal with molecules and cells and nerve pathways, we are taught to strip the emotions out of what we're doing, you know, in order to put forward a hypothesis and test it and measure and get quantitative documentation that different interventions have different effects on different outcomes, we need to strip the emotions out. And back when I wrote my first book, we started by talking earlier that even the notion that stress could make you sick was something that people were skeptical about.
Right,
they were still skeptical. When I published my first book in 2000, I had a lot of pushback from scientists and physicians, who you know, when I talk about stress, they'd all look stressed in the audience and practically run out of the room, but denied that there was such a thing. And certainly that it could make you sick was something your grandmother told you, and, you know, of course, that can't be real. But what happened about the late and early 1980s, mid-70s to the mid-90s, is there was a huge wealth of scientific evidence that accumulated, rigorous scientific studies that really proved the physiological basis of these stress pathways, how stress hormones are released in parts of the brain that are specifically regulating the stress response, that those hormones go through the bloodstream and nerve chemicals go through nerves. And those nerve chemicals, those neurotransmitters and those hormones, those stress hormones, have very profound and immediate and direct effects on the immune system, on how immune cells
right.
function,
and you were
on the kinds
one
of
the people who helped explore and explain that, right, in terms of
right
and
right and I in arthritis in rats. So when you show what I showed is that the brain's stress response was very important in susceptibility to arthritis in rats, and then we could transplant that part of the brain and make rats that were otherwise susceptible to arthritis resistant to arthritis. We could replace those stress hormones. We could do all kinds of things that really proved that there was a cause and effect relationship between that stress response and susceptibility to these kinds of immune-mediated diseases. Then the scientific community's skepticism fell away because one could prove it in scientific terms. And so up until 2000, when I wrote the first book, that's what had been really well explored and well proven in hundreds and hundreds of, if not thousands, of scientific studies in animals and in humans. And at that point, the field had not gotten as far as looking at the positive side.
Right.
That is, it was easier to stress a rat, a mouse, a fruit fly, a fish, a human, and measure something than to say to any of the above, okay, believe, you know, and then measure something.
And, you know, and I just want to interject here. One thing that's always been really helpful to me in your work is quite simple, but I think it's worth restating, which is we observe stress responses in animals and in human beings because the stress response serves a purpose, right? That it
absolutely
right, and that there are a lot of ways we need and use and are even protected by the stress response.
Absolutely.
But what
so
you're,
the stress response,
yeah,
right.
And what you're
the
talking
stress response
about
is life saving.
Is life right? And so it's certainly not essentially bad, but what you see and what you're able to see is when it goes on too long or it's sustained. Then, you know, when there's an excess of it, then it tips from being something that's protecting us to something that can be harming us. So
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know, so the stress response, that physiological stress response, is what gets you out of danger, the fight or flight response. It gives you the energy to fight or flee. Your heart's mm-hmm. beating faster. It's pumping more blood to the organs that need it, your brain and your muscles and so on. So it's what gets you out of danger. So the field, the way this psychoneuroimmunology field evolved in a way is that piece was proven much sooner in scientific terms than the opposite, than the flip side, how positive emotions, how positive salubrious activities could help make you well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason is the scientific tools were not available until fairly recently. It took longer to be able to develop really stringent means of imaging the human brain in an alive, wake human being. You know,
right,
because
right.
really, if you're going to study the question of belief or positive emotions in humans, I mean, you can't really study that well in rats and mice or fish or, you know, fruit flies. You really need to be talking to a human being and see how they're feeling and what state they're in, what mental state. So it took quite a while for those kinds of technologies to evolve to be precise enough to measure the nerve chemicals of desire, you know, dopamine, the nerve chemicals of the anti-pain neurotransmitters, the opioid neurotransmitters, endorphins in the brain, while somebody was doing something like meditating or praying. You know, so it took a long time to get those technologies, but when we got them, those kinds of studies just took off, and there's a tremendous amount of evidence now that positive emotions can activate brain pathways, nerve pathways that we know can help heal.
So part of the story that you are involved in and that I think you're going to be telling us as we keep talking is really of a whole new, as you say, neuroimmunology is a, what did you say, psychoneuroimmunology. Yeah, I mean, these are new fields, new ways of describing a scientific discipline. And you're part of these new encounters between neuroscience and other kinds of scientists and architecture and people involved in all kinds of spaces, from how hospitals are designed to civic spaces to contemplative spaces. So there's a whole cast, there's a drama unfolding, there's a cast of characters, and there's this whole new body of knowledge. It's really exciting. I mean, but some of it, as you say, as you said before about this whole idea that stress can make you sick, that your grandmother knew this, but we needed we needed generations of science to prove it. I mean, there's a lot of that in this. There's a lot of stuff that's absolutely fascinating and new, and then there's this affirmation of intuition. So, you know, I just want to start, one of the milestones in this story that you've talked about is Roger Ulrich's study called The View from a Window study of 1984, which was the beginning of one of these pieces of this new puzzle of what you now call environmental psychology. So tell that story as we start.
Well, so Roger Ulrich is an environmental psychologist who back in 1984 realized that he could actually do a clinical, well-controlled, randomized trial to measure the effects of views out of windows on healing. And what he did is he took advantage of a naturalistic experiment, if you will, where in a particular hospital, the Paoli Hospital in Pennsylvania, patients were admitted to a ward for gallbladder surgery. Back in those days, you actually stayed in hospital for a number of days after you had gallbladder surgery. And some of them randomly were assigned to beds with a view of a brick wall, and others had a view of a grove of trees. And he simply took the clinical data and measured how much pain medication these patients needed during their recovery, how long they had to stay in hospital, in other words, how quickly they healed, the number of negative nurses' notes where they were complaining or had pain or such. And he controlled for everything, age, sex, other medication use, other disease use, and all of these patients were taken care of by the same doctors and nurses. Mm. So it was an extraordinarily well-controlled study. And even with all these controls, where the single variable that differed between patients was the view out the window, what he found was that the patients with a view of a grove of trees left hospital on average a day sooner, needed less pain medication, and had fewer negative nurses' notes than patients who had a view of a brick wall.
So interesting. Yeah.
Well, and one of the scientists that we interviewed, I'll fast forward to one of the chapters in the book and also to the television show that we did based on this, The Science of Healing. Irving Biederman has a great quote where he says, you know, obviously looking at a view does something positive to the brain. And his hypothesis is that endorphins are released in that part of the brain that recognizes a beautiful or preferred view. And he said, why else would we pay hundreds of dollars more for a hotel room with a beautiful view?
Right.
You know, that really tells you that people are willing to put money out to pay for a view.
Yeah, but we don't think of it in terms of this is good for us. I mean,
we don't even think it that much.
We just know that's what we want. That's what we prefer.
Well, and I think that's the case with place in general. I think until I started doing this, until the architects asked me, so the then director of research of the American Institute of Architects, John Eberhard, and the director of research for the General Services Administration, Kevin Campshire, asked me, they build all the buildings for the government, asked me, is there a way to measure the effects of built space on people's emotions, mood, health, and ultimately productivity? Is there a way to design office buildings, is what they were interested in such a way that we can improve people's moods and productivity, ultimately, mm-hmm. and health in that space. And I didn't really think of it that much before they asked me. And I think what happens is we're so busy running through our busy lives. We wake up in the morning, we have to take the kids to school, and, you know, we go to work, and we have to, you know, rush through things and constantly focusing on our computers or our, you know, mobile phones or whatever. We don't notice the space that we're moving through. Most of us, if you're an architect, yes, you do, but but most of us don't really pay much attention to the place we're in. And yet, even if you don't consciously pay attention to it, even if you're not consciously aware of it, studies, including some of ours, show that your stress response responds very powerfully. Your positive emotional responses in the brain respond very strongly to the physical environment, to what you see and what you hear and what you smell and what you touch, and what you do in a space, because space, place shapes behavior.
So let's talk about some different kinds of experiences that again we have, and maybe things we kind of know without processing. I mean, so I think most people, or certainly many people, would agree that being in a beautiful place of beautiful nature is somehow nourishing, uplifting. You know, people would use different words. That it feels good and is good for us, and we often know that we're restored afterwards. So what do you know, what do we know now about what is happening in us physiologically then in those experiences?
I want, because you use the word restored, can I read something, a favorite psalm of my father's?
Yes, of course.
So in the last chapter, I say that my father was not a very religious man, but he would read his favorite psalm, which was the 23rd, sometimes after dinner, and he'd pull the Bible off the shelf, and he'd read it with both wisdom and calm, and it starts, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." I think that psalm, and I didn't realize it until I got to the last chapter of the book, and I put that in there because my father used to read it, I didn't realize that that really comes to the core of what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, I actually read that in your book as well, and was so struck by it. I mean, that's the 23rd Psalm. Your father was Jewish. For Jews and Christians, it's incredibly meaningful. I remember working on a floor with patients with Alzheimer's disease, and so many people there who had lost everything, every memory, could still recite the 23rd Psalm.
Right.
But right. I also had never considered how much that is. It's visual. It's a picture of place, right? It's the still still waters, the green pastures,
yes, green
and how
pastures.
That works things in us. That
right. And it does take you there.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, one of the theses of the book is that, yes, ideally, if we want to find a place of peace, we should go there, to this beautiful pasture near the near the still waters. But we can do it even if we can't get out of our hospital beds, even if we are in the valley of the shadow of death. We can go there in our mind's eye by reading poems like this.
And can you but is it, I'm assuming that that's still dependent on us having had those direct experiences in our lives.
Well, you know what's interesting is, and again, this is like Irving Biederman's work and other people like Russell Epstein and University of Pennsylvania have found that preferred scenes, beautiful views,
are they neuroscientists? Are they?
Yes, I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Uh-huh.
They're both neuroscientists who study the way the brain recognizes visual scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are different parts of the brain. Each does its little job, and there are parts of the brain that recognize things, tools, animals, buildings. Interestingly, there's a part of the brain that recognizes buildings, faces, and there's a part of the brain that recognizes beautiful views. And those preferred scenes or beautiful views are universal. They are generally
so green pastures and still waters.
Yeah. That's universal. Now, why is that?
But I guess what I'm getting at, is it linked to memory, or are you saying that we even have some template for that kind of visual beauty?
Certainly some of it is memory. You know, certainly smells, fresh mown hay or mm-hmm. fresh mown grass or, you know, wet mud in after a rain. Those kinds of things tend to evoke very early memories. It's mm-hmm. it's sort of like Proust, also taste, you know, mm-hmm. that goes directly, the smells and tastes go directly to the emotional parts of the brain and positive emotions or negative emotions. Mm-hmm. And some of it is learned. Some of it is learned by association. And we know that because not only in humans, but for example, in rats, very, very standard studies to measure the effectiveness of new drugs that have effects on mood or activity is something called place preference. And a rat will very quickly learn many features of a physical environment. The texture of the floor, the color of the walls, the intensity of the light, the smells, and can easily learn to associate either a positive reward or a negative reward with that exact environment. And if you change the environment, change the texture of the floor, the learned association goes away. I mean, anybody who has a dog or a cat whom you have to take to the vet and you put the animal into the carrier case, you know that it's really hard after the first couple of trips to the vet to get the dog or cat into that case because they've associated this unpleasant trip to get their shots with that particular physical environment. And the way to get them to not be anxious is to put a blanket over the case so they don't see it. Really, so that you remove one of the visual cues. So we know that certainly learned memories of a physical environment, which include all of the above, what you see, hear, smell, touch, can trigger positive or negative emotions depending upon what your experience had been. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a lot of the basis of what we call post-traumatic stress disorder now. Soldiers returning from war, right. People who've gone through huge trauma, and they associate the smells and the sounds and the visual cues of the battlefield when they come home with that huge, massive stress response that they had in the battlefield. So if they hear the backfiring of a truck, they'll have the full response, the full-blown response.
The whole place and the whole experience comes back.
Right. And in fact, the military, and I describe this in the book, is using that in their, again, the flip side of that, to treat post-traumatic stress disorder by using 3D virtual reality immersion and gradually reducing the cues, sort of mimicking the battlefield that the soldier was exposed to in this 3D virtual space, and gradually removing those cues and desensitizing them. And it seems the studies are not fully out yet, but it seems to be working very well.
But, you know, again, this... It's obvious. We've all seen this with animals, but it seems to me this is another example of it's true of us where we may be less conscious of this happening all the time, right? I mean, we know that when we're in a certain space that we're later going to associate with a bad experience, that we are internalizing the textures and sights and sounds and colors and light, you know?
I think the answer is no, we don't. And that's
one of the things we have.
And so one of the things that I discovered as I was writing the book and I became very conscious of is exactly that whether you're consciously aware of the your physical environment, it is affecting you. And one of the things that I tried to do in the book is bring out this huge amount of neuroscience research that was not designed to answer that question, but that does answer that question. And the reason is we know an enormous amount about the environmental variables that have to be controlled for when you're doing a study in animals to test the effectiveness of a given drug. And that's evolved over decades because that's how you know, drug testing is done. And we know that there can't be crowding because crowding, you know, stimulates the stress response. We know that light has to be a certain intensity, that it has to be 12 hours on, 12 hours off. We know a huge amount of you know, the temperature of the environment. Right. All of these things have to be controlled, and it's sort of a given. It's sort of, so what? Of course you have to do that. Otherwise, you're going to get too many environmental variables in your study to know what the drug did. Well, turn the question around, and you can say, well, wow, those environmental variables are really important. They're affecting the brain's stress response and the brain's relaxation response. Let's apply that to humans. Let's apply it to hospitals. You know, one of the things that I write about in the book.
Yeah, you know, this is, I had this, had, and this is just coming to my mind and surprising me from the extreme negative example. And, you know, mostly what I know about torture, I know from watching 24 on television, but right. That's exactly what, aside from just the things you can do to someone physically, it's creating a space, right? It's all this that you're talking about. It's going overboard.
Yes.
On sound
on the negative.
And
right.
Lack. Right. It's deprivation of all of those things.
Yes. Well, too much and too little is mm-hmm. the same as all biological systems. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, one of the things that I realized when I was writing the book is, why do we have to take for granted that hospitals should be stressful places?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's mm-hmm. when I lecture about this, I ask my audiences, how many of you, when I say the word hospital, associate it with a calming, wonderful, soothing place? And mm-hmm. people start to laugh. Yeah. Fortunately, that is beginning to change because of exactly the science that I'm talking about here. But until very, very recently, even 5 years ago, I would say, you know, people just said, oh, well, of course hospitals are going to be mazes where you come in the door and you have no idea where you're going and they're noisy and they're smelly and,
yeah,
you know.
And,
when you
go, and or bland and depressing in their
or isolation,
generic,
right.
Yes.
And, you know, and or fearful because there are mm-hmm. all these unknown big, you know, monster machines lurking in the corner where mm-hmm. you have to go and expose yourself to them. And. You know, if you think about when you go to a hotel in, you know, in a or a spa, you know, these industries have figured this out a long time ago.
I've been in some depressing hotels too, though.
Well, the ones that are positive, they want when
yeah.
you walk in the lobby,
yeah.
they actually pump in fragrances that are either, you know, mountain fragrance or beach fragrance or something mm-hmm. Meant to subtly elicit your positive relaxation memories and so on. You know, they're not mazes. They're not mazes stress you out because you don't know where you're going. And so why not apply this to hospitals and the beautiful views? And in fact, that's being done now.
I mean, another really basic thing that your work makes me be conscious of is, you know, light and color. And
oh,
again,
yes.
I mean, you know, kind of maybe we know this, but when you talk about, when you describe the places where we I think many of us have memories of being invigorated by these things, of being most aware of them, would be gardens or mm-hmm. or on the other end of that, stained glass windows. That somehow captures some of that same, you know, almost not just the restorative, but the energetic properties of those things.
Well,
so interesting to think about this.
Well, I think that's the very interesting point because, in general, we don't want to be always in a soporific state, mm-hmm, right? You want to mm-hmm. be that way when you're relaxed, when you're at the beach, when you're going to sleep. But equally, you want to be energized. You want to be happy. You want to have some sense of desire. You want to be alive.
Yeah.
Being alive means that you respond moment to moment to different external stimuli in an appropriate way. And people want to feel alive. I mean, I think that's why they go to places like theme parks, like Disneyland, Disney World. You know, you get on a ride and you really feel that zing, which comes from controlled stress mm-hmm. response, really,
mm-hmm.
Which when it's just a little bit in the right circumstances is actually energizing. So, you know, the physical place can do all of the above, and you can, you know, who else knows? Speaking of Disney World, I describe in the book a behind the scenes tour of Disneyland, and these people in theater, people in movies,
right,
figured all this stuff out a long time ago.
Before doctors
long
did.
Time ago.
Yes,
way, by trial and error.
Yeah.
You know, what's the first thing that happens when you go into a movie theater or a theater? What's the first thing that happens?
Well, it's dark. I mean, it's a whole enveloping experience.
It. Well, the lights go out.
Yeah.
What that does is it takes away your own reality, and it allows the producer to replace your reality with their reality because they've taken away the visual cues.
Hmm.
And so now you can immerse yourself in another place, in an imaginary place, and you forget about your surroundings.
Hmm.
So, you know, they figured this out a long time ago.
One of the really interesting pieces of history that you tell is that Christopher Wren, who was the architect who designed St. Paul's Cathedral, which is one of these, you know, one of these spaces, again, you can get more intentional about thinking about the power of that. We human beings have created these spaces that somehow exalt and that did he start out as an anatomist and he was doing illustrations for an anatomist?
Yes.
And wow.
Yeah. So I was speaking at the Royal Society of Medicine in London, and this august society has been around for, several hundred years. And I learned this interesting piece of information when I actually went to their library. And you can look at the original drawings of Sir Thomas Willis, the anatomist who first described the brain in perfect detail. He has this huge tome from 1664, where he, every page shows engravings of the brain in perfect detail. We cannot do better today. And they're sort of cross sections and elevations and three dimensional and two dimensional and every possible, you know, visual rendering of the brain. And at the very beginning of this, you know, 400-year-old book, there is a dedication to Christopher Wren, my colleague Christopher Wren, who is the one who actually drew those drawings. You know, who better than an architect to draw the drawings of, of the brain? And so there was this collaboration across disciplines, which you know, today we are carrying on in a different iteration.
So one of the big interesting places this points at is at what we have traditionally called the placebo effect. And there's been a lot of interesting thinking and revisiting of that term recently, and your work is, you know, very much speaking to that. Rather than me describing it, I mean, how would you describe, what you're learning, what you know, that, I don't know, would not only make us rethink, but perhaps rename this thing we call the placebo effect?
Well, the placebo effect really is the brain's own healing process.
Right.
And that's a long word, so it's probably easier to say the placebo effect. But the problem with the word placebo is it carries with it a lot of baggage.
Yeah.
It
feels,
you know,
like
people,
a trick, or there's nothing to it somehow.
Right.
And
the word placebo is usually preceded by a four-letter word, just.
Right.
Oh, it's just the placebo effect.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you look, and there's controversy about this too, the exact numbers, but when you look at placebo-controlled trials, the reason we have to do placebo-controlled trials to determine the, quotes, true biological effect of a drug or intervention is we have to subtract out the placebo effect, where people have an expectation that just taking a pill or having an injection or whatever the intervention is, they have an expectation that that will heal. And in fact, it does. It reduces pain. It can reduce inflammation to a certain degree. And it's hard to estimate, and it differs with different conditions. But the percent of effect of the placebo effect in any given intervention has been estimated to be somewhere between 30 and 90%. Right. 90 is probably a little high, yeah, and 30 maybe a little low. So let's say 50%. A drug that has the ability to help reduce pain by 50% is a very powerful drug. So, you know, it's not a trick. It is your brain activating anti-pain pathways, releasing those endorphin molecules, releasing those desire molecules, dopamine, so to shift and reducing the stress response.
It's in fact the drug that is a trick, right? Because what we do with the drug is trick our brains into doing that.
Absolutely, that's it. So, you know, so why not use this in an sort of a carefully titrated way and say, okay, why not put the individual who needs to heal into the most healing environment where the stress response is not activated, and to the extent that we can, it's reduced, where you have positive emotional memories that flood you. Put them into a situation where they're likely to release these positive, these anti-pain molecules and these, you know, dopamine molecules of reward. And that will allow their body to heal or to receive the drugs that you are then giving them. So I'm not saying, you know,
don't go to a desert island
right, and don't take your cancer chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying don't fight against it, mm-hmm, by putting yourself in a stressful situation. Do the maximum that you can with things like meditation and yoga and prayer to help amplify these pathways in the brain that we know ultimately can help the immune system do its job to heal.
Right. And it's very striking to me that, and you know, I wasn't looking for this. Yes, you were talking about some things like yoga and meditation and prayer. You know, you're also talking about light and windows and color,
yes,
and the right amount of noise. All of these sensory
sound, music,
But it does turn out that a lot of the examples you give and that other doctors give or end up studying do have some connection with spiritual traditions, whether it's looking,
yes,
at the architecture of a cathedral or you know, Richard Davidson studying the brains of meditating monks and
right,
therein making some of these amazing discoveries. You also devote a chapter to your book on healing spaces to labyrinths, which is a,
yes,
very ancient phenomenon, and kind of being rediscovered in the 21st century.
Right. And labyrinths are so interesting. I think partly because of the Minotaur, the Greek myth, people think originally when you say labyrinth, people would say, oh, that's a maze. And a labyrinth is very different from a maze. And labyrinths are calming walking meditations or allow you to walk calmly and meditate. And mazes are stressful places. So what's the difference? In a maze, you walk into a maze, and if you're a rat or a mouse, and if you're a human, you can go to, there's a wonderful maze outside of Hampton Court in near London, which was built by one of the kings of England back a few hundred years ago. And, you know, you walk into this hedge, it's got an 8 or 10 foot hedge, so you right away you don't see where you're going.
Right, but as you said, a lot of our buildings also feel like mazes when you walk
into them. Well, absolutely, and the reason they feel like that,
mm-hmm,
well, hospitals are built like mazes because typically you have the old original small hospital building, and then they keep adding wings, mm-hmm, to it, which hospitals until recently were designed really to optimize the diagnostic tools, you know, the x-ray equipment and the blood, mm-hmm, drawing and so on, rather than the human being that's going to be in that building.
Okay.
But airports, too. Just think about an airport.
Yeah.
You go into an airport, they don't really necessarily care whether you know where you're going. It's really where the planes are and how convenient it is to get there.
Whether you can walk all that way.
right. Well, that's walking is good, but that's another story. But but getting back to a maze, and you know, it's funny, when I was writing the book, I described these old dusty cathedrals and mazes and things, and my editor said, on the first draft, she said, "We've got to put something in there that young people would want to read. What about Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire?" And of course, I hadn't read Harry Potter. My daughter was old enough that I hadn't read any of it, I'm embarrassed to say. So I quickly ran out and bought the Goblet of Fire. And indeed, the description of Harry Potter in that maze and how he feels is exactly the stress response. It's a perfect, perfect description of the physiological stress response that is triggered when you are in a place where you're trying to navigate it with a time limit. You know, it's getting dark. You want to do this before it gets dark. You come to a decision point, so you have to have multiple decision points. That's very stressful. You don't know if there's a dead end, and if there is a dead end, there could be a monster lurking there. So the fears, very primal fears, are raised by these mazes. And if you put it back to going into a hospital, you're already stressed because you're anxious about your illness or your loved one's illness. Yeah. You can't find your way. There are these, you know, as I said, monster machines lurking in the in different corners where you're going to be exposed to them. Yeah. And so it really is a very stressful experience. Whereas a labyrinth is just a pattern on the floor. I described the Chartres labyrinth outside of Paris in
from
the Cathedral
the 13th
of Chartres.
Century.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's just pattern of stones in the floor, which has been perfectly preserved because the church didn't look kindly on labyrinths, and so they made sure that the benches covered the labyrinth.
Oh.
And so as a result, you can only see it, I think, one Friday a month, and but it's been well preserved. And the rose window of the cathedral is placed in such a way that the sunlight on the summer solstice comes right in and falls directly on the labyrinth. And there's all kinds of theories as to how that came about, and I describe it in the book and what it means, and all sorts of very interesting theories about these structures that are found all over Europe, also throughout the globe. And there are structures where you walk the path and you've come to the middle, and then you stand and you meditate in the middle, or you sit and meditate in the middle, and then you walk the path and come out. But you see where you're going. You don't have any dead ends. You have all your senses. You can see and hear, and you can navigate. You don't have to think about navigating, and so you're able to get into this place of peace where you're just, there's something about movement.
Right.
You know, I don't know.
I have to say, I walked a labyrinth just recently at the New Year. I haven't done that much of it, but also what's different from what you described about the mazes or being in a hospital is somehow you're right, you know exactly where you're going to step next, and you're not worried about that, but you stop being so oriented towards getting to the end. Which is an unusual experience in my life, where I'm always ticking off my next thing on my to-do box.
Well, no, it's true. It gives you that's a very interesting point that I hadn't thought of until now. So when you talk about a place of peace, which is really what I'm talking about here, how do you find your place of peace? There is an element of time to it. Or forgetting time, or not worrying about time. And we're so conscious of worrying about time and the time pressure in our world that it's hard to strip that away. And things like walking slowly, it forces you to walk slowly, right? Yeah. You can't be running through a labyrinth, although I have seen kids running through a labyrinth.
You actually feel like slowing down. I'm just thinking about this myself too. But there's something about the experience that makes you want to draw it out and slow down, and that in itself is kind of an unusual instinct.
Yes, I think you're right. I've walked the labyrinths in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and we actually have that in the television show. And one thing that they do that's very lovely there is they have music at the same time. And often it's a few people from the choir, or it's a wonderful flautist who plays sort of Native American flute or harp music. Mm-hmm. And it just gets you into this place of quiet and peace. And and slowing down. Another similar sort of experience I've had is with a Buddhist prayer wheel,
right?
That was or a drum, I guess it is, that was put into a lovely meditation garden in Sun Valley, near Sun Valley, Idaho, and it was done when the Dalai Lama visited there, and it was a garden especially dedicated to him. And when you push this prayer wheel around, it's actually quite heavy, and it forces you to slow down, and in order to just turn it around and keep the right pace so you're not falling off the platform, it really does force you to slow down and look at the surroundings around you and just be quiet and meditate.
So, you know, I think a lot about, we've often in the West, for the past few centuries, certainly thought about how science might and does seem to sometimes invalidate insights of religion. But it seems to me at the same time that can be true, that there's this interesting thing happening now. I mean, I'm also interested in what is the wisdom, and even really I see, you know, maybe spiritual technologies that these traditions actually have carried forward in time over many centuries, some of which are now being validated by science. And so, you know, it strikes me when we talk about how many of these examples have to do with, it's like you said, theater people have known this for a long time about creating an environment. And it's also true of religious spaces. And it's everything from gardens to prayer wheels to labyrinths to stained glass windows to incense to music. Actually creating this environment that you are learning can help heal us.
Absolutely.
Isn't that interesting?
Absolutely. It is. And it's, you know, I talk about frankincense in the book, in the chapter on smell, on the sense of smell, and how fascinating it is that frankincense actually turns out to have immune-boosting features. And, you know, because I always, as a non-Christian, I always thought it was rather odd.
In the Christmas story,
the gifts of the magi. Uh-huh. Right. It's, you have frankincense, myrrh, and gold. And I said, why are they giving these weird things, frankincense and myrrh? They should be giving diamonds and rubies. And in fact, those resins, those fragrant resins and oils were far more valuable than gold or diamonds or rubies in those times, because they actually used the Roman soldiers, and it was said that Bathsheba gave the plants to King Solomon.
To King David?
The Queen of Sheba. Let me start again.
Get your affairs, your biblical affairs right.
Can we cut this out? The Queen of Sheba. Yeah. It's close, but okay. So, you know, the frankincense was so valuable, and myrrh, that the Queen of Sheba was said to have given the plants to King Solomon. And then when the Romans came into the Holy Land, they took those plants back to Rome and had them guarded by sentries, because they were used, these resins were used to heal after battle. To heal wounds, to prevent infection. So, and new studies show that, in fact, frankincense and these kinds of molecules do have beneficial or boosting effects on the immune system. So there's a lot of you know, lore that can be studied now in a rigorous scientific way to understand how it works.
I wonder if you've ever heard of the... He's a recently deceased Irish poet, philosopher, John O'Donohue. Anyway, he talked a lot about landscape, and that there are outer landscapes and there's an inner landscape, Which is one way, another way of talking about, you know, what's going on in that psalm that your father loved, the Psalm 23, but also that we all have these landscapes. And also I think his point was we can create them. You know, we can choose to keep images of beauty inside ourselves, even when that's not what mm-hmm. is directly around us. I don't know. I just wonder how you hear that, knowing what you know about this science and what's going on in our brains.
Well, I think it's absolutely true. And from a scientific point of view, there is a part of the brain that specializes in memory of place, the hippocampus. I mean, it's important in all sorts of memory, but it's very key in memory of place. And one of the things that it seems that the hippocampus does is it integrates all of these incoming sensory signals from the visual cortex, from the auditory cortex, from the olfactory bulb. So what you hear and see and smell and touch. And the hippocampal cells that are actually called place cells because they tell you where you are in the world. So it's kind of like your internal GPS system. Those little GPS cells actually have inputs from all the sensory modalities in the brain, and they integrate those senses and instill the whole in memory. And so, in fact, from a neuroscience point of view, the poet was right that we do have an internal place that we can go to from our memories if we can dip into it. And that is one of the points that I make in the book, that ideally, yes, we would all love to be able to go to our favorite Greek island, you know, and I describe that.
Yeah.
But what I learned from that personal experience in my own life
is that... Where you had a real healing experience on a Greek
island. I had a real healing experience when I went to this tiny village in Crete called Lentas, and I had, you know, that was when my arthritis first appeared. And I tell the story of how I serendipitously ended up going there with neighbors. And in a 10-day period, I began to feel so much better. I didn't heal. It wasn't like the miracle of Lourdes, which I also describe in the book. But I felt so much better that I realized I could recreate this world at home. And so I have on my deck in Washington, I have a gardenia tree and jasmine bush, and I can sit there and in the evening in the summer and listen to the crickets and inhale the scent that reminds me of the orange blossoms and lemon blossoms from the Mediterranean. And I have lavender and I have basil and, you know, all these fragrant plants that I find very soothing and healing. And you can create your own little space wherever it is. And if you don't have a deck, you can, you know, put a few plants in a window. If you don't have a window, you can read the 23rd Psalm.
And you're really saying this is medicine, not
yes.
It's interior decoration maybe on some level, but it's medicine.
It's medicine, and it is being applied now. The wonderful thing is that because of the science, because we have now more and more rigorous studies that show the beneficial effects on mood, on health, on the stress response of these different aspects of the environment or manipulating the environment in this way, the designers and architects and urban planners can now and are being able to incorporate these features into their designs. So hospitals are being designed with beautiful views and with windows and with places for social support. We haven't talked about that, but social support is important in healing, and with smells to mask the,
right.
the horrible
and,
smells
but you have
and the
to
sounds and
the
so
space,
on.
Space. You have to create spaces for social support. I mean, even in workplaces.
Well,
right?
It comes back to the practicalities. Mm-hmm. Yes, so it comes back to the practicalities and why the architects and designers and urban planners need the science. Mm-hmm. And more research is being done now. That's, I think, the frontier. We need to now do the actual research to get the numbers to say, it is worth spending extra money up front to put in more of these windows and spaces and so on. And some of the work has been done. The Center for Health Design in San Francisco sponsored us, together with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, sponsored a series of studies called the Pebble Projects, where they understood that you're not going to build a whole hospital from scratch and say, I think this is how it should be, and oops, it didn't work, let's throw it down.
Yeah.
So they started these studies where health outcomes, various aspects of health outcomes were measured in patients in new wings of hospitals that incorporated these different features. Mm-hmm. And then Derek Parker, who was one of the principals involved in this, added up all of the actual costs from these different kinds of extra wings that were built on 50 different or 30 different hospitals, and said, okay, this is how much it costs extra to build such a hospital if we were to create such a fable hospital, he called it.
Right, right.
He calculated it would cost about $12 million extra to build such a hospital, but you recouped about $11 million in the first year of operation because of the savings on not only the health of the patients, but the health of the staff. So, you know, that's the kind of evidence that we need, and more is being done now, to really document that it's good not only for the human being in the space that you build, but it's good for the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of the very exciting things that I've found since I published the book is that architects are just embracing this all over the world. So I've been invited to a
member. Yeah, you're in those
member.
Discussions, aren't you? They're,
I am. Uh-huh. It's just wonderful. It's so exciting to see it. So I'm a member of an advisory committee for the American Institute of Architects. It's called the Design and Health Initiative. Mm-hmm. I'm advising the U.S. Green Building Council on incorporating these kinds of features ultimately into, hopefully, the LEED certification of buildings. And it's not there yet, but that would be a goal. I was invited on a 5-city tour of Australia to speak to the Australian Green Building Council.
Hmm.
I mean, all over the world, architects, designers, urban planners are just embracing this. And the bottom line is, what I tell them when I speak to these audiences is, you, the designers, the people who create the built space that we, the rest of us, live in, you are our partners, our meaning the health professionals' partners, right, in the health of the nation. You are our partners in prevention of illness, in helping to reduce the stress response, in helping people to find a place of peace, because you're the ones that build those places of peace.
Mm, mm. You know, Esther, you there's a beautiful, succinct, and very profound sentence in your writing. If illness and health are nouns, then healing is a verb.
Yeah.
And I wondered if I could ask you that on a more personal level. As we've mentioned, you are one of the people who helped demonstrate the science of how rheumatoid arthritis, for example, is a very good example of how mind and body, emotions and physiology are connected. And you also are a person now who lives with arthritis. So I wonder if you could tell me, you know, with all of this we've been talking about as a background, you know, what does healing look like as you move through the world now? And what does it look like differently because of all these things you're learning?
Wow, that's a good question. So healing, when I say it's a verb, it's the body is constantly repairing itself. That's what life is. You know, a rock just sits there and it gets it eventually gets into sand or mud or something as the elements affect it. But a living being is constantly repairing itself against all of these different insults at a very, you know, molecular level, at a cellular level, at an emotional level. And so disease happens when the repair process is not keeping up with the damage process. right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a very active processes are going on under your skin and actually on your skin as you exist at every moment of the day and night. And so that's what healing is to me. There are other, you know, there's many studies asking the question, what is healing? And different people have different concepts of what the word healing is. And to be healed, you know, you can die healed. If you use the word in an emotional sense,
not
you
cured,
can feel
but healed.
Healed, mm-hmm. Right. You can feel at peace. You can feel in balance. For me, I guess it is feeling at peace and in keeping up with that damage process. So if one has an underlying chronic illness, and I'm very, very fortunate that the inflammatory arthritis I have is A, not rheumatoid, and B, relatively mild okay. to moderate. I have a gene that predisposes to mild to moderate inflammatory non-rheumatoid arthritis for those listeners who are interested yeah. in the specifics.
Yeah.
But so what happens is I have become very conscious of the kinds of things that I do that will trigger my symptoms to be worse and the kinds of things that I can do to the extent possible, reduce those symptoms when I'm going overboard. So, excuse me. So there's no question that when I'm pushing myself, when I'm stressed, when I'm trying to burn the candle at both ends, I get worse. When I don't sleep enough, I get worse. When I don't exercise gently on a regular basis, and what I've found is the most helpful is swimming 3 to 4 days a week, or in the summer even more, or walking 30 minutes a day, which has been shown to be beneficial for maintaining health and maintaining the strength of the immune system. So gentle exercise, enough sleep, reducing or coping with the stresses of the day, having a place to sit and quietly contemplate or meditate. These are the kinds of things, and social support and love. You mentioned love is very important. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of things that when I forget, and I'm human. I do frequently forget and push myself and I get stressed. And then, you know, as Hans Selye said, stress is life and life is stress. I mean, forget about it. You can't stop stresses from happening.
Right. Which helps my stress level to acknowledge that.
Right. Well, but what happens is when I do realize that I'm pushing myself too far, I remember how bad I felt when I didn't stop. Mm-hmm. And I do those things that I know will help me. And I did design my deck at home and my sunroom at home in such a way that I do have my place of peace. And actually, that's where I end up doing most of my work. I used to have my computer in a different room, and I found that I kept moving it to the sunroom, and I finally said, okay, this is obviously where I want to be. I need to have
this
atmosphere.
Well, that's interesting, because I think computers are part of a lot of our stress, but you're actually saying that maybe even that can be in the right environment can
it gives
be
you a
positive.
Way to yes I mean so I mean one of the things with the stress response is you don't need to go offline, and I mean offline, mm-hmm. off your brain's line, not off the computer line, for very long to kind of reset things. So if you're cognizant of this, you can, if you feel your stress level mounting, and you just turn away and look at the trees and listen to the birds, and be quiet for a few moments, you can bring it down. You can titrate it. Mm-hmm. You know, there are tools now available that are really offshoots of biofeedback, where you can do this. They're like computer games, actually, where you put a little sensor on your finger or your earlobe, and it senses your blood flow, and it will tell you when you breathe deeply. So deep breathing is one thing that calms you, because it reduces the stress response. It kicks in the vagus nerve, and that improves heart rate variability and blood flow. We're going to breathe here on the radio, and yeah. so um, So, and you can actually see your heart rate variability improve and shift from a stress mode to a relaxation mode when you use these little games. And so you can actually teach yourself to go offline, to have that shift into a relaxation mode on a moment-to-moment basis. And then you can go back and focus on whatever it was you were doing.
Your life.
And being in a place that allows you to do that helps you to do that more efficiently.
Mm-hmm. So from that scientist's scientist who you were when you first started getting into this unlikely connection between emotions and physiology and where you've come now, as a person who rearranges her physical space, thinking of her physiological health. If I ask you this way, how has your sense of what it means to be human, how do you think that's changed?
Wow. You always ask such great questions, Krista.
Well, that's kind of a big one. That's the question
like
of the philosophers across the ages.
Well, I was going to say a therapist, but... Yeah. How has my sense of being human changed? I think I'm much more accepting of these notions that I was skeptical about before. I was coming from the scientific tradition, and the tradition was, if you can't see it, it isn't real. If you can't prove it, it isn't real. And I think I'm much more accepting that, you know, maybe there is stuff that we can't see or prove, but that these things really are affecting our emotions and our health. And I think I'm much more open to these new concepts. And so that's one thing. I am definitely much more conscious of the physical place around me. And I, you know, you started by saying, as a person who rearranged my physical space on purpose based on these principles, actually it was the other way around. I rearranged my physical space without realizing what I was doing. And then when the construction was finished, I stood there and looked at it and I said, oh, I just rebuilt my parents' deck.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, takes
that
me back
into... place of peace from your...
place of peace, that, yeah. Right, the memories, the memories. So I guess I'm more aware of these things, and I'm able to look at these phenomena and think, oh, okay, now I see why I'm doing that. I don't always fully understand it, but I think it helps me to understand it and to be more consciously aware of how place affects me and those around me and my emotions and my health.
Mm-hmm. There is a phrase that especially occurs in Celtic spirituality, and it's thin places.
Huh.
I don't know if you've ever heard that, but it's...
Yes.
Yeah, and the idea is... a lot of people would think of cathedrals as thin places, or, you know, green pastures, still waters.
Uh-huh.
This experience that human beings have of being in a place where, and this is the way some people will say it, it feels like the veil between heaven and earth is worn thin, where there's a sense of being earth, you know, planted in the earth, and yet also having some kind of almost physical sense of transcendence.
Yes.
I just wonder how you react to that, knowing what you know.
Well, I react to that. I have heard of that notion, and I do think that there are places where one is more aware of creation and of, you know, a higher power, call it God, whether you believe in it or not. You know, you go out into the night sky and, you know, a place like Tucson, Arizona, where it's dark because they have the observatories, the telescopes around there, and you look at the masses of stars and the Milky Way, and you feel very, very, very small.
Hmm.
And you realize that, yes, there could be some other some other force of creation that you have no knowledge of. And I am actually very interested in exploring what is it about such places, about beautiful vistas of mountains, about the infinite horizon of the ocean. What is it that makes you feel that way about a cathedral? There are certainly physiological and neuroscientific basis to that feeling, that sense of awe. And I am convinced, I know, that these things can be measured. And that's the exciting new frontier for me, to ask exactly that question. What is it that makes one feel transcendent? And is the environment something that we can consciously manipulate to find those feelings of transcendence? You know, if we're so grounded in clay, is there a way to, at times, by simply going to a different place, achieve that sense of awe and transcendence?
And again, I mean, Christopher Wren knew something about that, didn't he?
He did. And, you know, when I visited the cathedral, it was very interesting because I walked from the Royal Society of Medicine to St. Paul's Cathedral, which is not a short walk, but a very interesting walk in London. And I got there, it was just before Easter, and there was a single man, you know, the soloist, I guess, of the choir, who was practicing, I believe it was from the Messiah. And he was standing in the middle of this dome, and with this crystal clear voice that rose to the ceiling, it just gave me shivers. It was really a sense of awe. So it wasn't only the physical place, it was what that place did to sound that contributed to that sense of awe and transcendence. So yes, Christopher Wren understood this explicitly or implicitly and created places to, as did all the Gothic cathedral designers, with, as you said, the light, the stained glass, and the smells, the frankincense, and all of it that comes together to make you feel that sense of awe.
Well, we're out of time. That was great. Is there anything else, just another minute and a half, anything you want to add?
I think the most important point that I came to in my own journey in writing this book is that we really can create places of peace, not only in our real world, in our physical environment that surrounds us, but in our own mind's eye. And those kinds of places of peace are portable. You know, you can take them anywhere. And as you said, in many different traditions, like the Buddhist tradition, or in virtually all religious traditions, you close your eyes and you visualize something. Well, you can, that's a way of carrying these environments, these healing places within you. It's wonderful if you can go to them, but if you can't, you can bring them to yourself.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always wonderful talking to you,
yeah,
Krista.
Yeah, it's great. And we will we'll let you know what's happening with this and when, and if there
great.
Are
we'll,
we I know we want to ask that question about your credentialing, so
yeah,
we'll talk again soon.
Yes, and now we're offline.
Yeah.
Are we recording?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I'm going to be in St. Paul at the end of the month, April.
Oh, at the end of April. Okay, good.
Yes.
Okay, so just send me your dates.
I'll send you the dates, and I'm going to be speaking at the U and at the Marsh.
Oh, all right. I'll come out and get a massage and then listen to you.
We'll do it together. I'm not going to give it.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much, Krista. This is wonderful.
Thank you.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.